the guy walks up and you know, the guy in charge, he walks up and he said, "Where's the prisoner?" I said, "It's the guy in handcuffs."
Pretty obvious.
Right. And he reaches over and grabs him, starts walking away. I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. Those handcuffs are accountable property. You got to put your own cuffs on there and give me mine back." Exactly. I love the marshals, man. That was just a funny
story. Yeah, well, they, you know, maybe they just weren't used. You know, DEA and regular cops, when you're exposed day in and day out to these kind of situations, you don't sweat the small stuff and you don't kind of, you get rid of some of that military stuff, you know. I don't know. Maybe it's just the marshals aren't exposed to the day-to-day stuff that we did.
You know, I have a theory for it. They're the FNGs, what we used to call the FNGs, the fucking new guys. These guys want, that's their first time out. They want to, you know, look prim and proper.
Right. You know? After they've been through it a while, the senior guys were probably, you know.
Whatever, yeah. Yeah, just get your ass on board. You know? Yeah, yeah, you over here.
Yeah.
Hey, well.
Exactly.
So, let's talk a little bit about that too. You know, now that this name starts coming up, what did you know when you started hearing that name? You know, how did you start digging into who this person was, who she was? How did you start putting together your folder, you know, your dossier on Griselda?
Well, I relied on some of the historical stuff that DEA through Lois Goodall provided, Olga, the informant. And then we started asking certain, you know, most of the Colombians that we detained that weren't involved directly in a homicide. Like I said, if we hit a house that had five or six knuckleheads in there, they all lied about who they were and all that kind of stuff. But we started asking those kind of people, "Hey, have you ever heard the name Griselda?" And of course, they knew her name from Colombia. And they'd say, "La Madrina, the godmother." "Oh, yeah, the La Madrina." "And tell us about her." And they say, "Oh, we don't want to talk about her." Most of them didn't want, you know, they just would tell us what the hearsay, what they had heard, that she had killed her husbands, that she was responsible for this murder or that one or what have you. But they didn't have any concrete, you know, evidence. So I would put it down in a memo. I'd write about it, but I would, of course, note that, hey, this is just what we have heard. We don't have any way to really prove it. But that's how her fame began to be noteworthy in our files.
Were you able to get eyes on Griselda during this time, or was she just more of a, you know, in the wind there? All you had was names.
Right. All we had at that time was names. I didn't see her personally until 10 years later.
No shit.
Yeah. Wow. Alan, my husband, is working with Rivi, the hitman that she used quite a bit. He wound up in the Netflix series bringing her. I think they made it look like it happened in Los Angeles, but they brought her down to Miami. The scene where she throws up and all that wasn't me in the car. It was another female detective that was working. Because by the time they captured Griselda, I had left homicide. And I was working in the Special Investigations Division in the Organized Crime Intelligence Unit. And Alan calls me up because he knew that I had worked her years before and said, "Hey, I got Griselda in the office. You want to come down here and look at her?" So I did. And she looked like an old grandmother.
Yeah.
No, yeah, the Black Widow, the spider, and the so let's rewind a little bit. Let's go back to that too. So as you're working this up, how long does it take you to get what you think is a good picture of her organization and how things are structured and what's going on? How long does that take you?
Probably about 6 months.
Okay. And when, you know, and by the time you get this done, what strikes you most about this? I mean, it's like, you know, the fact that she was under the radar for so long, how big her enterprise was, you know, what are the things about it now that you've got a pretty good picture of her that stood out to you? Other than the fact that here's a female narco trafficker, you know, leading an organization.
I think the thing that stood out to me was the level of ruthlessness from a female, and that she seemed to have some connection to so many of our cases. even if it wasn't a direct hit by her, it could have been someone that worked for her that was killed, or someone that had owed her dope, or she owed dope too. She seemed to have a finger in every pie.
Hmm. Wow.
If, and I know, I don't know that you remember this or ever knew it, but if you had to guesstimate how many murders she was responsible for, could you come up with a number?
In Miami, in Dade County, or mm-hmm. all over the country?
Just in your area, your jurisdiction.
Yeah, in Miami.
There's no prize directly, for getting it right.
Now, let me add, directly responsible for, or indirectly and directly?
The ones that she either directly or she ordered.
I'd say probably about 30 directly.
Wow. Okay. And then kind of indirectly, things that her tent part of her organization was involved in, or things, you know, when you think of the tentacles of her organization, how many overall homicides do you think she had a fingerprint on?
At least 200 nationwide.
Wow.
Yeah, I would say so. In New York, in LA, and then if we count the ones in Columbia.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd say there was that many that her organization was responsible for. Or, you know, somehow influenced or popped up. Now, I could be wrong, but she was, you know, a heavy hitter.
Now, somebody that violent, like you say, between Columbia, between Miami, between New York, between LA, all these different areas. Well, and the nature of the drug trade in itself was violent. So violence begets mm-hmm. violence, makes it bad. As you're investigating this, you know, what, I mean, obviously part of the goal is to build a case. You want to arrest somebody, you want to indict somebody. What was the challenge with building a case to where you could get to that point? Did you have enough at that point? Did you go to the district attorney or the U.S. attorney and they say, we need more? Kind of walk us through some of your challenges during that time.
Well, she was such an ethereal, and you know, when I was looking at her, and there were other, you know, mini organizations that were other little tentacles. She wasn't, like I said, I didn't meet her until 10 years later. She was a ghost, like Griselda. Oh yeah, she did this case, or in New York, she was responsible for this, or she hired a hitman to kill somebody in Texas, or, you know, whatever. She was not graspable. You know, she was behind it, but we couldn't concretely, and none of the hitmen or the people that she used, they weren't going to talk to us, other than when Rivi got caught years later, he flipped basically to stay away from the electric chair. But other than, she was a very vague, I mean, we knew she was real, and we knew she was responsible, and we knew she had a lot of influence, but it was very difficult. She was like smoke to grasp her.
What was she doing operationally that made it so difficult to pin things on her? What was she doing to kind of insulate herself?
Well, I would say that she was using, she did, you know, she was using any available sicario, hitman, 2 and 3 steps removed. She would hire some, you know, she had a group, that an inner circle, and then they would hire people to kill someone. And none of those people that she hired or that she contracted with, they didn't say, oh yeah, I did this hit for Griselda. Even if we could grab them and pressure them. She was very good at, first of all, she scared the hell out of all of her own people. You know, and she was good at moving around. You know, at one point, oh, she's in town. We might hear from, yeah, she came through here, but now she's in New York. And what is she doing there? I don't know. By the time we'd check out whatever the hell or somebody she might have killed there, she'd be gone again. And oh, she's back in Columbia.
Let me ask you a question. Like I said, I didn't want to talk too much, keep going back and forth at the series from my standpoint, but it started off, I asked Murph about this and he didn't know. So the series started off, and you'll see that there's a saying from Pablo Escobar that says, the only man I was ever afraid of was Griselda Blanco.
I never heard that, but I wouldn't doubt it.
we were trying to source it to say, I don't know. I mean, I know I asked you, Murph, right? You never heard that before, right?
No.
I heard it that she was very scary, and a lot of them were terrified of her, but I never heard that exact quote.
I'm going to guess that's a Hollywood thing.
The other thing that I think is a Hollywood thing is I also never heard about her alleged first husband making her sleep with the brother.
That was kind of gross.
I don't know if that really happened. Maybe they got that from the son, the one surviving son. But I had never, and you would have thought that all those people talking about Griselda would have told.
Yeah.
They would have said, oh, yeah, that the reason she's so angry is because she was made to sleep with the brother.
I'd be angry if I had to sleep with my brother, and I don't have one. So, hey, but I'm going to put Murph on the spot for a second, June. You're going to appreciate this. So, mm-hmm. Him and Javier, they've been doing their speaking thing for a lot of years. Yeah, and this Griselda is just proof is that there's still this interest in historical things about what goes on. But they go out and they do their presentation, and there is a special section on Griselda, isn't there, Murph?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Javier,
really?
Javier talks about her. And if you look up Griselda on Wikipedia, there's a photograph over there. And that's her mugshot there in Metro-Dade PD. And we talk about before Sofia Vergara came along, they were actually going to do a special on Griselda. And they talked to Jennifer Lopez, J-Lo. So as he tells a brief story about Griselda, because actually she was before our time in Colombia. But you know about her because of the association with the Ochoas and Pablo. And he says, when he tells about this, he said, we've heard that there's going to be a new series coming out portraying Griselda and her life. We don't know how that's going to work because, and then he pops up a picture of Griselda and he says, Griselda was uglier than shit. And it's that mugshot.
You don't know how many people on our an internal Miami-Dade Police website, Facebook, everybody and their brother was saying, my God, they picked a beautiful woman like Vergara to play this. And there's two people couldn't be more different and on and on. Man.
Even the hours they spent, it would have taken them. There's no way they could have even filmed during the day because if they'd spent the time it took to make her look as bad as Griselda did, the day would have been done.
Well, I watched an article about Sofia talking about that, and she's a beautiful lady, Colombian lady, and she was spending like 3 hours in makeup before they'd start filming. They could never ugly her up enough to look like Griselda.
Now, my understanding is that Michael Corleone got pissed off that his mother was bad-mouthed and looked, that many people had commented that Vergara was so different. And he said, my mother was, maybe when she was younger, she was okay. But by the time she really got to going in the action, that life will do that to you.
She lived a rough life. That's right. That's right. And, it's her son. And he, I read where he filed a lawsuit against Netflix and all that crap. But you know what? When Narcos came out, Pablo's brother filed a lawsuit and it lasted about 3 weeks.
And who did we talk to, Murph, that also filed a lawsuit that we did an interview down at the Southern California Gang Conference? The son of the Cali Cartel?
Oh, yeah. William Rodriguez Abadia. He was Miguel Rodriguez Orihuela's son or nephew.
Yeah. So see how all these names, that's what I'm saying. This is so incestuous when we start talking about Eric Newman has got his fingers in everything narco. I'm beginning to wonder if we shouldn't investigate Eric and see what he's got.
That boy's doing good.
Well, this Netflix thing has resurrected and we have heard from people, Alan and I both, that we'd lost track of, Channel 10 ABC new correspondent who was one of the only journalists that I trusted. And he called and said, oh man, and we all remember more or less the insanity of those times and how wild it was. It was just wild. Miami was Casablanca, with machine guns. It was wild. And we had a bunch of other stuff. We had, during that time, shortly after, we had the Mariel boat lift. And we had all the insanity of all the criminals, Castro flushing his toilets. We had our own little Jamaican gangs. We had the I'm trying to think, the riots after cops had killed a couple of black defendants. It was just wild. You know, we didn't have, we were overwhelmed. And that in the movie, they show where myself and my lieutenant, we go up to Washington, D.C., and we testify in front of a Senate subcommittee because we needed money. We had revolvers, and the bad guys had machine guns.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, what's reminiscent of, we had Rick Massa on. Rick was LAPD, the North Hollywood shootout with the two bank robbers that were heavily armed, and LAPD was having to go around and get, you know, M4 rifles and stuff. And had it not been for the SWAT guys actually armed, you know, with, you know, real rifles.
Real M14s or something.
Yeah, with the real shit. I mean, but that's to your point, right? Cops have always been outgunned. You know, same thing when you first started. I first started, Murph, it was flintlocks. You know, I had black powder rifles, but mine was, you know, revolvers. You were learning right. How to, I had ammo dumps, load one round at a time. And here's, but then you get somebody with a MAC-10, not that they right. need to be accurate. They just throw a lot of lead. You know, it doesn't matter, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And that was one of the favorite weapons that the dopers and the Colombians were using was the MAC-10s. And, you know, they were not particularly accurate, but what the heck? They were just spraying each other's houses and homes and parties and, you know.
And those weapons were menacing looking. It was like the Tech-9s also. That was a popular weapon used back then.
And then they went to Uzis.
Yeah. You know, the Uzi, I mean, if you get the mini Uzi, the barrel's, what, 2 inches long at most? The accuracy on that is terrible, but if you get the longer barrel, it increases significantly, but it's just spray and pray.
Yeah, but even like with that Uzi with the 2-inch barrel, you just, all you're doing is hiding it under a coat. That's all you want, you know, just
mm-hmm. Concealability.
Concealability.
Yeah.
Well, hey, June, let's kind of move forward a little bit too, because like you say, how long, let's kind of bookend it too by saying, how long did you work on Griselda before you moved on to something else? So how many years were you involved in the investigation?
I'd say about 3.
And during that time, did you get to the point where you had enough to indict her, you know, to file charges?
No. Not while I was there.
Yeah. So as you were working through that, I mean, when you moved out of homicide, did you stay in homicide and just go to a different area, or did you move out completely?
I moved out completely because my son was getting to be at that age of 13, 14. And I realized I couldn't stay working the insane hours in homicide, and I needed to have a little bit of more of a normal life where I could go to his ball games and, you know, stuff like that. And I hated to leave in a way, but, you know, Eric was a priority. So I wound up going to a district and doing this very boring paper shuffling job in their crime analysis section. And they, you know, we would identify hotspots in the district of burglaries or robberies, and we'd let the local district detectives know the different trends. In fact, that's how I wound up, you know, as a female. I was detached to a lot of assignments, especially because I also spoke Spanish. But I wound up identifying, you were mentioning in the old days not having anything but blood types for rapes and things. We didn't have DNA. We were having a rapist that was working with, he was called the pillowcase rapist. And we had a rapist that was working the Kendall area. And one thing led to another. I start going through the files. I'm in the district after I left homicide. And I see we have a bunch of panty thefts and Peeping Tom incidents, and I match him up more or less to about the same time. There's this guy, his name was Beasley, and I sent his name up to the sexual battery people. I said, I don't know, but this weirdo has been around in the general area of the rapes. Bingo. They make him on this old lady he raped, and he had taken her glasses off, and his fingerprint was on her lens, on her glasses. So within a month, the captain or major, whoever was assigned working those cases, tells my district commander that they want me to work with them. And so I got detached to work the pillowcase rapist task force for, well, probably a year and a half. But that's the, that, you know, it, and it wasn't, once again, it didn't take rocket science. I just was noticing these little things that were happening in the district.
Well, and don't sell yourself short there, because not every police officer, we know this, not every police officer has that ability to remember minute details and then put them together to help solve a case. I wish we all did. I was, you know, yeah. I was never as good as what you're talking about. But so the whole point is, don't sell yourself short. You recognize it for what it was.
Yeah. But it was very satisfying, although I didn't expect to get detached. And I was like, oh boy, here we go. And once again, I was the only female, other than the two or three clerical people we had working with us on the task force. They gave us a different building and everything. We rented it. Then we got into, back then we didn't have, you know, was the subject a secretor, like you mentioned, or was he a non-secretor? And had he been in jail or in prison because he wanted to have anal sex with some of the victims and what, you know, all this.
Yeah, and that's such a behavioral clue too. A lot of people don't realize, but a lot of times when you have anal rape like that, one of the things you go back and pull is, okay, who just recently got out of prison?
Because that's what they know.
And Murph, I was going to tell you, do you know why women are so good at the intelligence piece about pulling all those little things together? You and I have been married long enough, right? Women don't forget anything, do they?
No.
No, they don't.
They don't.
Exactly. So I guess that's, you know, one of the things that you, because you remember these little details and these little, and I can remember faces much better than names.
Yeah, but yeah. I can see your interview going in. You remember that time 10 years ago when you.
When you, yeah. That's right.
You.
Hey, on a side note, did you ever have any dealings with a drug trafficker named George Young?
Ooh.
They called him Boston George. He was he partnered up with Carlos Later, coming out of Norman's Key there for a long time.
Now Later, of course, I'm familiar with, but I don't remember that name, George Young.
Okay,
well, just the movie Blow that Johnny Depp did, that was based on George Young. We got George's last podcast interview. He was interview number two for us, and it was funny. We were talking with him about going down there to Norman's Key and, you know, confronting Carlos, and he was going to kill him. He says, you know, so I asked, we learned some things about George we didn't know, like worked for the CIA, you know, was paying off the Castro brothers. And then I said, have you shot people? I said, okay, come, more than five or less than five? He goes, yeah, let's just say less than five. So wasn't he down there in Barranquilla when somebody threw somebody off the balcony too?
Yeah, according to the movie.
Yeah, according
to, you know, well, you don't know if it's Hollywood or not.
Well, Hollywood's true. I mean, it's all true. So,
yeah. Well, it's on the big screen. It has to be.
It's on
true,
the big
right?
screen. Well, let's get back to you, Joan. I mean, as this was going on, though, did you stay in touch with the people working on Griselda, or did that kind of fall off your radar because you had moved on and you had other things to do? I mean, how much of a touch point did you have?
Yeah, I kind of fell off the radar, except with Al. He wasn't my husband then, but he knew. He inherited the Centax squad that I had been working on when I left, or not because I left, but I left, and then sometime later, after the River Cop investigation, or maybe it might have been before, he winds up being the supervisor of the squad that is working on most of those Centax drug-related cases. And so he knew that I had, you know, but he's the only one. Occasionally, I would get a copy of some report or something, or a DEA thing from homicide while I was in the district in Southwest. Hey, guess who got arrested, or guess what, you know, what, because I, but it was through him that I, you know, would occasionally hear about what happened related to drug cases.
So let's kind of bring it full circle, because they continue to work this. Did you get pulled back into the case at any point, you know, when it was nearing the end, or when they were looking to make the homicide cases on her? Did you have additional involvement, you know, even years later?
I'm trying to remember the sequence of this. 83 is when I got pulled into the pillowcase rapist stuff. But now I'm back in the sort of the sphere of influence of the headquarters bureau, and I wind up working for criminal investigation, well, special investigations division, which was up on the third floor above the homicide bureau, and I'm working intelligence, you know, but it was focused on Colombians, which, you know, we did have some peripheral stuff, but it wasn't focused on homicides. So I'm thinking 83, 84, and then in the mid to late 80s, after the, that's when I'm, at some point around there is when Al calls me and says, do you want a Sig Griselda? It was after, you know, I'd say after 84, 85. I don't remember when they brought her up to the Homicide Bureau. So he's working her. He's got Rivy. We started seeing each other in 88, Alan and I. And so it was after that that he starts working Rivy, the hitman. So but let's say it's like 90, 89, 90, that he's developing enough of a case through Rivy to get Griselda. And that's around the time that I... Yeah, because if 79 Dade Land, like 89 or 90, 10 years later is when I actually get to see her.
And Rivy, they did accurately portray in the Netflix series, but this is the dude that had phone sex with three of the secretaries in the DA's office. Yes.
As far as I know he did do that, but as far as I know, he didn't do it to benefit Griselda. He just did it because he was a snake.
He did it because he was a pervert. Yeah, this is...
Yes. And, you know, they try to... say that he kind of did it because he knew it would screw up the case for Griselda. That created in the state attorney's office an avalanche of just all kinds of finger pointing, and a lot of the girls or the women that were somehow involved in some of that phone sex stuff wound up saying, well, if you're going to finger point to me, guess what? This guy grabbed my ass and this one did this and the state attorney. I mean, they started, you know, and if you know cops like I do, some of our own policemen had relationships that were a little dubious with some of those same young women. And so everyone was like, holy, you know, it was a diarrhea of the mouth with everyone thinking on each other. So they moved the entire case over to Tampa, I think, wound up being over Hillsborough County or something, because it was just a mess. And he triggered a lot of that. Rivy did.
Yeah, well, and that's what I'm saying. It just, no matter what happened, like you said, it turned it into a shit show.
Exactly.
So, but let's talk about you meeting Griselda. So you finally get to see that it's not a ghost anymore. You know, it's a real person. So as you walk in, what's your first impression?
That she looked defeated. And, unimpressive. You know, I thought, so this is the great Griselda. Of course, she'd been through some shit by then, but it was anticlimactic. She was not, you know, remember, I had envisioned years ago all this, I'd heard so much about how scary she was, and I'm sure she was, but at the time that I did finally see her, she was very diminished. Appeared to be very meek, angry, but meek.
Well, she no longer had power anymore. She was in custody, yeah. Her entire, no money, you know, no status anymore. Did she know who you were? I mean, tell us, how does the introduction go?
So.
Do you walk in, you go, hi, Griselda, I've heard a lot about you.
Never got introduced. Alan just brought me in. I just walked into the room and I stared at her. And I'm sure she had no idea who I was, which was fine with me. You know, but she, I don't remember if I even said anything to her.
Yeah, again, as we said, the Netflix series, they do their own thing. I do want to ask you one thing, because your son did bring it up during the interview when you said people were messing with you. And, you know, we have to ask. It's the infamous scene. Come on.
Oh, with the air conditioning?
Yeah.
I can tell you even worse that they didn't put in there. I told this to Doug. Yes, they used to turn up the air conditioning. And the way I even found out about that was because we had this hysterically funny, really cool black secretary named Valerie. And she said, June, you know, they do this because they would get, you know, in the big bullpen of homicide detectives, they'd talk freely. And she would, you know, they would forget that Valerie was sitting there. Anyway, and then I used to, of course, we all had desks and stuff. And I had this chair that was one of the better rolling chairs. And it somehow always wound up on my desk. And it was leather and it was comfortable and had arms. Oh, guess what? So at some point I said something about, gee, it's really nice of them. And Valerie looks at me. She says, June, when you get up, they sniff the chair. I told Doug.
You sure Rivy Doug wasn't Mirror. Working in that section? As per- You guys have been talking Doug, to Rivy again?
Doug's reaction was, you know, we men were such pigs. yeah. And I said, well, so then what I started to do when I found that out was whenever I was going to get up and leave the room, I'd rub my butt against the chair and I'd say, hey guys, I'm getting up now. And then, you know, that kind of embarrassed them, I think. I don't know if they continued to do it or not, but yeah, that's the, you know, what am I going to do? You have to give it right back. You have to punch back. You can't let them offend you. Can you imagine if they had done that today?
Oh,
in today's world?
Well,
oh,
you'd be worth about $25 million right now if they did it.
I mean, oh, Lord. They, you know, so, but that was the, it's, and it's not like I just, there was another time when I was working in intelligence up in Organized Crime Bureau that they sent me into a salon, for example, to get my nails done to try to talk to the wife of one of the, somebody, you know, a doper. And so I'm talking to her. I get the assignment done. I get back, two guys, two detectives had, you know, I got out of my car, undercover car. It was a station wagon. It was real cute.
Of course it was a station wagon. The mom mobile, you know, put a child seat in the back.
Exactly. A baby seat in the back. And so I get in, I get done, I come back, and they have been in my car. Okay. They said, hey, walk around the corner and get in. So I get in, and the son of a bitch is one of them has. They had gone into my workout bag, and I used to, and he's got my bra over his head like Mickey Mouse ears. You know, they're just clowning around. Can you imagine? I'd have owned them all over again. But I laughed. I just, you know, let it roll. That's just, that was, you know, if they hated me, they wouldn't have done that.
Now that's,
that's a strange part of the culture.
Oh yeah. Well, we had a drug task force going and working with the city, the county and stuff. And one of our evidence technicians, her brother was actually my class counselor when I was a state trooper. And we're out there, we're waiting for the search warrant to happen because somebody's hidden dope inside a gas tank. We're waiting until we get the word, et cetera. So our evidence technician, I won't say her whole name, but it was Sandy, but she's like, I got to pee. Well, we're out in the middle of the country. I don't know what you want to do. So, okay, we'll turn our backs. You go between the cars. So she goes between the cars. Well, when she did that, one of the guys hopped in there, and he turned on the bright lights.
Oh, of course.
And all we saw was like a periscope, this hand coming up with the middle finger.
Yeah, exactly. I used to carry a roll of toilet paper in the trunk of my police car, my patrol car, for that very, you know, reason that, you know, sometimes the bathrooms that were available were either really dirty or you're out in the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, that like you said, it's part of the culture. You just have to be willing to take that. You can't be offended at every single thing.
Well, you can these days, it seems like. But
yeah, well,
we all come from a different time.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And they were truly, they were my brothers, you know. I've only had a sister, but my colleagues, whether it was in homicide or in the Organized Crime Bureau and the intelligence, they became my brothers, you know. And I would ask them. After all, I was never a little boy, so I went to them to get a lot of insider information on being a man, or being a kid, or being an adolescent male.
Yeah, and so you could deal with Eric.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so they were like my brothers. I didn't generally, and even if somebody was a little bit ugly with a comment or a joke, I ignored that. That's that guy's problem, not mine.
Hey, but you know, you bring up a good point though, June. When you started, you may have been, you know, and some people say, well, you were just hired because of this or that. Doesn't matter. You may have been hired for whatever reason, but the point about it is over time you proved yourself. And I think that's where you got the respect of people.
Repeatedly.
You proved yourself. It's not like, no, I'm not just here holding down a seat. I'm just not taking a slot. I'm earning my keep. I'm doing my work. And by the way, I'm bringing you cases and helping you solve cases you couldn't do. So you can tell that to Mr. Dickhead. Nanny boo boo.
And I think in the beginning, you know, they thought, oh, like most men in those times, they thought that you were either A, looking for a husband, or you were a bimbo, and, you know, or you were somebody that was easy and they could sleep with you at any time or what have you. I had real life issues. I had a son. My mother, for God's sakes, was living with us. You think I'm going to be party girl? Hello. Besides, I was a serious young woman. I had to be the breadwinner. I could not be, you know, Miss Party Girl. I had an example to set for Eric.
There you go.
Well, we, like I said, we had him on. You did a good job with him. His episode is going to come out after yours intentionally, because I have to tell you, he did supply us with some inside information, which you voluntarily disclosed. We didn't even have to drag it out of you.
He did, yeah. Did he tell you about the bedroom raids? I used to do bedroom raids on him because he was messy, like a lot of boys are. And whenever I get into his bedroom, I just look at that and say, okay, everything goes in the middle of the room. And in that process, a couple of times I discovered some Playboy magazines, you know.
Oh, typical. I'm shocked. Playboy magazines? Oh, what a shock, right? Oh,
yeah,
my back. God.
And so I stacked them. I folded them and stacked them very neatly. And he said later on, he came in there and he realized that I had these. Oh, my God, Mom discovered my Playboys.
Now, June, you should know by now, nobody's going to rat themselves out. So he didn't tell us that. But it's good to know, because I think we're going to throw that into our intro. He was only ratting you out. So
There you go.
He must have told you about at some point. He's kind of a wise ass, and he says, hey, Mom, why don't you take a – I was, you know, complaining about something that he was doing. And he said, oh, so you're going to – why don't you just take my television and my – and I said, oh, good idea. And I loaded all this shit up, his records, his television, into the back of my police car and locked it and kept it for a week. So
I bet your neighbor offered a suggestion again, did he?
Yeah, he never offered that. Like, you know, he was going to be cocky. Right? And another time he said something, but I want to go live with Dad. I said, oh, really? Oh, we're not going to. When I turn 18, I'm going to go live with Dad. I said, nah. He was about 10 then. I said, you're not going to wait till you're 18. I packed his little suitcase up and put him out on the street. Took him a good while. I mean, a couple, three, four, five blocks from the house. Now, I secretly followed him as he's crying with his little suitcase on his way back. But I said, don't you ever tell me that you're going to live with your father. Don't you backtalk me like that. So I was a bit of a ball buster for a mother. Poor thing.
He picked the wrong lady to pick on. I remember my daughter got so mad at me. She was like 15 or 16, kind of at that age where they know everything. So yes. I come running in the house one day. I said, Amber, follow me upstairs. Quick. Let's go. Hurry up. Pack. We got to go. She says, what do you mean? She says, you need to move out while you still know everything.
That's a good line. Yeah.
She was so mad at me for a while.
I think everybody has those stories. We had our oldest daughter, Monica. She was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old. She came in one day and she said, I'm running away from home. She was mad because we wouldn't let her do something. So she went, packed her little suitcase, and she took off down the street. Of course, my wife's following her at a discreet distance, just keeping an eye on her. And then she comes back. We're like, what happened? Well, I'm not allowed to cross the street.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my case, I knew that if I didn't make Eric a – his father was a good-sized guy. Eric was not a giant of a kid, but he played football. You know, he was going to be...
Well, he was bigger than you.
Exactly. And I had to put in his little brain a little bit of fear that I was a little crazy.
No, we did his interview. You put a lot of fear into his little brain, not a little fear into his big brain.
And I'm, you know, I'm 5'3" on a good day, and I'm shrinking with age, so... I knew that I had to kind of conquer him psychologically. And my mother, God bless her, she never openly defied or countermanded any of my discipline, but she would secretly come around and say, you know, he's a young boy, and she'd lobby on his behalf. Mm-hmm.
She's been a good grandma.
Most grandmothers. And she would secretly kind of, you know, so then I'd lift the, you know, all right, instead of a week, you know, 3 days of being confined, you know, stuck at home or whatever. So, yeah.
Hey, well, June, so let's kind of, you know, we've had you on for quite a while. So let's kind of bring this to a close, because there are a couple questions I want to ask you, though, at the end. Once this was done, did you have any idea how big of a story it was going to become at that time? Because, like, the same thing I asked Murph and Javier when we actually, they were our first interview, but we talked about that. And we had Chris Feistel, Dave Mitchell on, they did the Cali Cartel. There's a lot of cases that you don't realize that at the time, it's like, it's just another case. You don't realize they're going to be big. When did you realize that Griselda was going to be, you know, something that was going to be at that level of a Pablo Escobar, you know, or of the Cali Cartel, Medellin, you know, kind of stuff?
As far as Netflix presentation, or just that it was going to be as big of a story as it?
Yeah, just as a big of a story, because, you know, you work a lot of cases. It's like, you know, we knew about the pillowcase rapist from your son. He said, make sure to ask her about that. Well, you already told us about that, but that's not something, if you say people in Los Angeles go, yeah, I know about the pillowcase rapist in Miami.
Right,
but when you say
right.
Pablo, when you say Griselda, you know, those names,
oh,
they know.
Oh, man. When did I know that it would be...
Well, let's put it this way. Was it before or after you retired?
Oh, it was before. I knew it was fairly big, but I didn't ever expect it what's happened now with the Netflix thing.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I knew that Griselda and her part and that whole drug homicide craziness of South Florida, well... You know, we lived it, so we took it for granted. So it was probably a combination. It was big for us, but I didn't think, like you said, all the attention and the attraction and the fascination of the younger generation until after we retired.
Because she did pop up in a few documentaries here and there, you know, her name's pulled up, but Netflix really kind of put her, as you might say, on the big screen. Anytime you do a series like that, a six-part series, you know, and the story gets out there. But there's always a danger, too, is that when people look at this, so for example, Murph, I think this is a good way, there's a couple things we want to tell you about. You may not know, but one of them, Murph, tell her about your deal with Eric Newman. You turned down the Pablo story several times because of a certain issue.
Yeah, we had two producers. A friend of mine up in, and I was living in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area. A friend of mine introduced Javier and I to two different producers. And, you know, we never thought anybody would want to hear the story because it had been so long. And so I went and met with these producers individually, and both of them wanted to take our story and make political statements out of it. You know, and it's just like, yeah, I'm not interested in that. So we turned them down. Well, then when Eric called, the first time I talked to him, he was telling me what's going on. And I said, you know what? Thank you, but no thank you. And I know he probably fell out of his chair because, as you've seen, you know, people will sell their souls to go to Hollywood.
Oh,
right?
Man. Yeah.
And so he.
Can you
he
say
said,
the last narc?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a whole different story there.
Yeah. That's my point, right? Nightmare. They'll sell their soul. Anyway.
Yeah. But he flew to Washington with Doug and Carlo. We all had dinner together, and at the end of the night, after he explained everything and bought my dinner at a very nice restaurant, by the way.
You cheap ass bastard. You weren't going to go out there unless they bought your dinner.
Well, if they had a free T-shirt, that would have sealed the
deal.
That
would have been
it. But that's when we decided, you know, well, let's talk a little bit more and see how this goes. Our first contact was in February of 13. I met them in March. They came to D.C., in May, we signed contracts. In June, I retired from law enforcement after 38 years. And in July, we were sitting out in Hollywood writing season one of Narcos.
Wow.
But
that was fast.
But here's the thing I want to ask you about too, June. But Murph, but there was one kind of rule you had about portraying Pablo.
Yeah. So, and that was the end of the night. So, I mean, you know how we are, June. As cops, when I went into that restaurant, I didn't know these guys, but I knew I was looking for three guys sitting by themselves, and it was a French restaurant, so it was a little bit classy place. And I walked over and picked them out, and I walked up and I said, gentlemen, I'm a police officer. I just received information one of you is holding cocaine, so get your three asses up on the wall now. And Doug and Carlo about freaked out. Eric's just sitting there, started laughing hysterically.
Oh my God.
So at the end of the night when we're leaving, they're like, Eric said, why are you and Javier so hesitant to do, you know, to tell your story? And I said, Eric, the last thing we ever want anybody to do is glorify a guy like Pablo Escobar, who's nothing right. more than a mass murderer.
Exactly.
And, you know, he said, I promise you right now, we'll never do that. And to, in our opinion, he's lived up to his word.
So yeah. That's the reason I wanted to ask you is, how do you think the portrayal of Griselda was in the Netflix series compared to real life? Did they make her a little bit too likable? Do you think it was at least fairly
absolutely
accurate?
We had no input, nor did I know that their theme was going to be basically my character is good female with the terrible men that I had to work with versus her character, which is kind of the bad female and the terrible men that did her wrong. We did not know that that was going to be, and maybe it wasn't initially, but that turned out to be the emphasis. They made her too likable in the beginning, especially. They made her a victim of the male world. And I would never have, they can do what they want. And that, I think, is what they perceived would sell in today's day of women as victims and toxic masculinity and all that bullshit. That's what sells, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, they made this, we always say good guy versus bad guy. This is a good gal versus a bad gal is what they
right.
made this
that
into.
Was the spin that they gave it. And I understood that when I started watching. I said, okay, this is, you know, in today's world, in the Me Too movement, sort of kind of flavor, this is what they, and it was a Hispanic thing too, you know, so I understand, and they had license to do what they wanted. They inserted and changed a lot of things, but it wasn't something that we either knew about or that we would have pushed, you know. I would not have allowed, or if I had had more editorial input. I mean, Vergara was one of the producers, so she had to have given it a good deal of the flavor she wanted, and that's fine. But I would not have made the character as sympathetic or her hitman type of husbands as weak as they appeared to me, because they were cold-blooded killers.
Yeah.
And they did make them look subservient to her.
Exactly. And that's what sells in today's world.
Well, that's the danger, right? You got to, at some point, it's still a product. They've got to sell it. They've got to sell it to an audience.
Right.
And if it was historical and accurate, it would have been called a documentary, not a Netflix series. So
right. So that's what when some of my, police colleagues were bringing up all the things that they said, how come the, this guy, Diego, appeared to be a nice guy, and Dario was, and I would say to them, listen, this is what sells. After all, Netflix isn't in it to make an accurate thing. They're in it to make money.
Yeah. They're not looking to win some historical, award for
exactly.
accuracy. Yeah. Hey, well, let me ask you this. Because we all know, in reality, we all know how she ended up. She ended up dying by the same device she had created, the drive-bys on the motorcycles. When you got that news, did it shock you? Did you go, huh? How did you react when you heard the news?
I just clapped. I'm sorry, but I thought it was great. Die by the sword, live by the sword, die by the sword. And I thought, well, she finally got hers. She pissed somebody. Who knows how long, whoever it was that whacked her, was waiting for that chance.
Well, years. They were waiting years.
That's it. Absolutely. And they must have just, finally said, okay, today's the day.
That's one of the points that Javier makes when we're talking about Griselda in our presentations is that these Colombian drug traffickers have very long memories.
Yeah.
They don't forget.
Well, and the sad part is she should have been in prison for life.
Yes.
Never should have seen the light of day. Yet she's allowed to get back out and do what her victims weren't allowed to do, which is go on and lead a life at least for a while. But here's something I don't know. So let's do a just a quick trivia contest for you, June, to end out our episode here. So, Griselda at 69, she's dead. Shocker, folks. You know, both Griselda, everybody's room temperature, right? So she was buried in a cemetery called Jardins Montesacro Cemetery, south of Medellin. Mm-hmm. For $200, who else is buried in that cemetery?
Oh, man. Escobar?
Pablo Escobar. Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
There
ding,
you go. Wow.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
She is buried not too far from Pablo.
Well, that's kind of poetic justice, too. It is, you know, maybe, you know, maybe that's... So you can go visit the two assholes at the same time. You know, geez.
Here's something you'll appreciate, June. So some agents that were, this is years after Javi and I have already, you know, left Columbia. And so this is, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years ago. I got an email with a picture attached, and a couple of agents from DEA agents from Bogota had gone up to Medellin and working with the cops, and they went by the cemetery. The picture, they took a DEA badge and placed it on the headstone of Pablo Escobar's grave, took the photograph, grabbed the badge, and ran like hell to get out of the cemetery.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, the pictures that was circulating in Metro Dade after Escobar got killed, with him all bloodied up and everything, we made copies and handed it out. As gross as it was, we passed it out to everyone.
Did you see the goofy picture with the redneck wearing the red shirt holding Pablo's head?
No.
That was Murphy. Go back and find that picture. That was Murph. Murph shows up in his Target shirt. He like he's working at Target. Got Pablo's head and is like, hey, say cheese.
You know, I don't know if you know this, June. I'm the one that took all those pictures.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, they made the rounds in Metro Dade, I'm telling you.
All right.
We passed them out. I bet you they're still in the file that I probably made on Pablo Escobar, and I stuck that Xerox copy of that in his folder.
I like it.
Hey, well, let's close up by doing this. So what are you doing these days? You know, you got out of police work. What are you doing?
Well, we retired in 2004 and five with it, like December and January, right? His was a little different date than mine. But we built a house in another area in Tennessee on the mountains, beautiful area and everything. Big house, but a lot of rocks and crevices. And about 4 years ago, we moved here. More normal, because I realize as we get older, all those 16 steps down, you know, and all around everything, that wasn't going to cut it when you're 70 years old. So anyway, we moved here, and I do a lot of gardening. I paint. I went back to my original, I never have given that up as a hobby. And I paint all kinds of things, watercolors and oils and all kinds of stuff. And I grow a lot of flowers, and I do a lot of gardening. And Alan volunteers at the VA. And I had my three dogs. Now I have none because I had to put them all down because they were old. So eventually we'll get another dog. I just said to Alan, we have, you know, a couple of dogs rescued. They were all rescued. And I said, let's just give our hearts a break. You know,
I know the feeling, yeah.
You get attached to them, you know, they become part of your family. And one of them was 14, been here with us forever. So I love my dogs, my birds. I have bird houses everywhere. I do a lot of the gardening, and I paint.
Well, with the Griselda thing, now that it's hit, are you getting a lot more requests to do interviews or additional series? You know, what has triggered there?
You know, I am not. And one of the reasons I am doing this with you is because you're former law enforcement. I'm not a big fan of journalists and news people in general. What a shock, right? You know, Alan did something with Fox Nation. I have a request from CNN from Greece. I may or may not do that one. There's a woman she's originally from Scotland, but she lives in LA now. She used to do intelligence analyst stuff for the...
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, she used to do stuff for either Scotland Yard or MI5. I know who you're talking about. Yeah,
she reached out to me.
Yeah,
I may or may not do that. I'm not a glory hog. You know, I just don't. I did my job. I'm not a hero. I just did my job. I worked hard. And most, you know, this isn't the be all end all of my identity. I'm a mother. I have wonderful grandchildren. I had other facets in my life. This was a wonderful part of my life. I loved being a cop. I was good at it. But, you know, now I have to turn the page and do other enjoyable things.
Well, you know, and I'm glad you said it just like that, because that's the point of Game of Crimes. You know, we want to show all of our listeners that cops are just normal people. It's just we selected a career that happens to be all encompassing, and it becomes a lifestyle.
Well, some
for
of
you.
Us are normal. I got to tell you, I've never sniffed a leather seat. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I realized that as a woman, when my normal female friends, the ones that have never been policemen, they just think I'm so weird and such an oddball. They just, you know, and I have to step back and say, okay, if I'm a regular housewife or a receptionist or whatever, you know, now to look at what I did for a living, they have to be just appalled. And they basically say, well, weren't you afraid? And you say, yeah, of course you get scared. But, you know, and well, how could you see all those dead bodies? And you say, you know, it just becomes part of what you have to do. But they find that very unusual. And I understand that, because that's not the normal world, especially of a woman.
Yeah, but then you get homicide guys who are homicide detectives that'll walk in and see dead bodies. But then the first time they have to change the diaper on their kid, they're throwing up and running out of the room.
They're like, oh, okay.
I can't do that.
Exactly.
Hey, final thing here, because you're the expert on this. So we do our Patreon channel, and we do what we call the narcometer. Mm-hmm. So the narcometer is we rate and review all the different things. Like I said, we've done narcos, we've done Boston Marathon bombing. I mean, you name it. We review all these things. Well,
wow.
So you are the ultimate expert on Griselda. So our narcometer is rated on accuracy, authenticity, and believability. So we combined score, we give it a scale of 1 to 10 kilos. 1 kilo is not even close. 10 kilos is knocked it out of the park. So you, June Hawkins, Detective June Hawkins, the expert on this. Great, Netflix series Griselda on a scale of 1 to 10 kilos. 1 kilo, not even close. 10 kilos, nailed it. How many kilos do you give Griselda?
As far as the adherence to truth, or just in general?
Just overall, accuracy, overall. Authenticity, believability. You know, just combine. Just give us a score.
Oh, wow. 7.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty good.
Did you find it entertaining?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I'm giving it a 7. And I'm because it is a fascinating story, even as they presented it, even though it wasn't as accurate as I would have preferred.
Nothing is accurate, you know.
No,
in Narcos, exactly. They had Murphy at the shootout, and he was back at Carlos Holguin, you know.
Yeah, I wasn't there.
They have me in the shootout with one of the hitmen in Milcar, the little girl that portrayed me. I'm standing behind a wall. I was there. I was in a car, and we were chasing him, but there wasn't an exchange of gunfire between us. But
that's Hollywood.
That's Hollywood, you know, so that's one of those things.
That's why they put at the front of that thing, you know, characters, some of the stuff has been fictionalized, you know, for...
Right.
Hey, well, look, I got to tell you, first of all, I know you got a lot of requests, but thank you for doing this, because we've had, I guess, probably you were in the top three of all guests. People kept saying, we got to hear from her. So we've done, we've done 136 episodes, 37 episodes now, so... the fact that you are in everybody's top three list of, hey, you got to get her on. So this is us saluting you, saying thank you for doing a great job.
Thank you. Really, thank you very much. I'm just a regular person.
Yeah, and it's been an honor to meet you, and I echo everything Morgan just said there. Thank you very much for giving us your time. I know it's a pain in the butt, but
thanks for walking me through all this technical stuff.
Well, that's what Morgan does. He's a nerd, you know.
And I bring gas.
You're AAA, right?
Oh, You could have. We could have gone. I'm editing that out. Who told you to say that?
Nobody told me to say it. It just stuck in my head.
Oh my God.
That was your nickname.
Oh, thank you, Gene. You just made the whole interview.
I'm going to find out who ratted me out. I know people now. All right.
Oh, very good.
Oh, what a great way to end the show.
It must be an inside joke big time between the two of you.
Well, he was a trooper, you know. I mean, he changed tires and we got people gas.
That's why he called me AAA. So. Well, as I tell people, AAA is 25 times better or 24 times better than XXX. So there you go.
There you go.
AAA, who everybody wants to be rated A. So that's me, AAA, Canadian. So, hey, well, June, thank you very much. I can't tell you how much we appreciate this to get you the expert on the show. But again, enjoy your retirement. Enjoy painting those things because you've earned it. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Hang right there. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. I know you set me up, asshole. You told her, say AAA. You told her.
I didn't tell her. I told her about AAA. I didn't tell her to say anything.
She dogged me just like Eric did. Her son and mother throwing shade.
And it was the same thing with Eric. And you'll hear, I mean, I told him about your nickname, but I didn't ask him to do anything. There's, you know.
I didn't ask you to do anything, you know.
It's part of the culture, man. Here's an opportunity to take a shot. Let's take it.
But the other thing, though, too, is the story. So one story we did confirm, the story about them using the air conditioning, you know, to cause an obviously physical reaction.
Yeah.
But we didn't learn about something that she told them but did not make it into the show, because I even think the show thought this might have been a little bit too weird.
Oh, the seat? The leather chair?
Seat.
I tell you what, man, some cops are pigs.
And we won't tell you about the conversation we had afterward, but just suffice to say the conversation we had afterward, that's the real story. There's a lot of other stuff that was going on.
Oh yeah. June, just thank you so much for coming on the show and thank you for your personality, for not taking things personal, for being a real professional, for leading the way. And you know, you earned the respect of all your male counterparts there.
I know that's tough to say, Murph, because it's got a few words to run in, you know, sequence there.
It's getting close to nap time, you know what I mean? I mean, we've been working hard today, so but it truly was a joy and a pleasure to have you on here. I loved that your analysis of what's real, what's kind of true, and what's not true, because it fit almost exactly with us.
So I was going to say, we asked her, she said basically 30, 40, 30, you know, and it's like a third, and a third. So it was like spot on.
Yeah. Yes. And to Eric and the guys out there, y'all did another fantastic job. So congratulations on Griselda.
And Sophia, if you're listening to this, you know, hit us up, man. We've got room on our podcast to, you know, interview Griselda.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was reading an article afterwards after we hung up with June, and apparently Sophia Vergara has a continuing back problem now because of the way she portrayed Griselda. They had her walk a certain way to make her look shorter in stature.
Yeah.
And it ended up causing a disc problem. She had there were some days when they were filming, she wasn't able to film that day because of the pain. And even though it's all over now, she's still having a continuing issue with it.
I wonder if she gave up her smoking habit too.
Oh, she said her doctor told her, stop, you can't do this, you know, at your age. I think the article read it says she's 50, that, you know, you shouldn't be doing any of this. So I don't think she smoked before the series. I read another article.
No, that's why I said that she never smoked. So this was, yeah, you could tell too, because it was, you could see it was awkward, you know, the way she was holding and doing stuff. But
yeah, I'm not sure what it is about Eric and the guys, but, you know, same way in Narcos, Javier and I, neither one of us smoked, and they, you know, before
they had,
we,
yeah, but, they had Pedro and Boyd just lighting up all the time.
Oh my gosh, it was. I guess they think that was part of the culture back then.
Well, and even in Narcos Mexico, man, the only thing that's not on fire, you know, is the room that they're in half the time. Everybody's smoking away. It's just like,
you know what? Thinking back on all the agents we had there in Bogota with us, I think there was 23 agents. I can only remember maybe two guys that smoked out of 23 guys.
Wow.
Yeah. So whatever.
Well, it's TV, you know, but that's why they make the big money. And, you know, we're still doing podcasts.
There you go. Hey, we're making the big monies. We're up to $18 a month now.
Hey, 18?
Yeah.
You've been taking your half out of the middle? What? All right, guys. Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Go head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Let us know what you think about it. But June is just a total rock star. And we sincerely mean this. She may have been hired early, you know, on in the 70s because they needed to hire more females. But let me tell you this. She earned her way through everything. She earned every bit of respect that she gets for this role and for her work that she did. So this is us saluting you. Terrific job. So head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Remember, you can also leave comments on Spotify. So do that for us. Let us know what you think about it. Head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com, the website. There'll be some pictures there about June. Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go to Game of Crimes Fans, type it into your Facebook search utility, and pull up our group. Ask to join it. And our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist with the velvet glove. If you are deemed worthy of entrance, you shall be allowed. So just answer a couple easy questions. But where you got to be? Patreon. .com/Game of Crimes. Why do they got to be there, Murph? Tell me. Why do they?
Because there's so much good stuff on there. That's, you know, you guys know, if you've listened to us any at all, we try our best to stay apolitical here. You know, we want the guests to tell their stories. We do interrupt them when they're talking, but it's because we have a reason for doing that. So if that bothers you, you know, don't send us any more of those nasty notes. We know we're interrupting, but we're doing it for a reason. We're not being rude. But when you go over there, things are different. We get very opinionated. We might talk politics. It might get a little, I get on my soapbox every once in a while and I'll preach to you for a minute or two and then Morgan shuts me down.
A minute? I'm sorry. You know how long we went on one of those episodes, Murph?
Well, I mean, sometimes I'll go on a rant.
You went so long on that, your wife had to bring in oxygen to you to keep you going.
But it's always a lot of fun. The episodes we have on there, especially the question and answer, we have not turned down a single question from our listeners yet. We talk about everything, families, opinions. We even got one guy that sends in the rapid fire. We call him
Rapid Fire Rick Jacobson, man. Good stuff.
You know, do you like this or do you like that? It for me, it's a lot of fun. I love it.
It is. So come join us, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Well, hey, you know what, Murph?
Yes.
It is another exciting end. And you know what? We got the real story. She gave it, on the final thing, Narcometer review, she gave it a 7. I was surprised she gave it a 7, but she said it was entertaining.
Yep.
She liked it. And therefore, we end up with the 7 on the Narcometer review. So there you go. The authentic, or the authoritative source has ruled.
That's right. And you want to be here for next week's episode when we talk to June's son. I mean, I think you're going to be real surprised about him. We were surprised. I didn't even know it when I was trying to find June, he reached out to me, and that's how we've gotten to be friends since then. And in fact, I'm wearing his t-shirt right now.
Of course you are, because it's free.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I saw you wearing a Pablo Escobar t-shirt because it was free. It said free Pablo. And then it said, oops, sorry, I forgot he's dead.
Not true.
Pablo is too dead. Don't tell people it's not true.
Yeah, but the t-shirt's not true.
And guess what? June didn't know, but she guessed it. Guess who? Griselda's buried next to Pablo.
Mm-hmm. Same cemetery.
Same. Well, hey, if you want to hear more interesting facts, tune into us as we launch our new trivia show, you know, Game of Trivia. So, hey, until next time, folks, but thank you guys. Thank you for being players out there. And thank you guys once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the original, unadulterated, and totally authentic Game of Crimes.